Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson, a little under the weather, so you've got that low voice like Barry White. Can't get enough of your love, babe. This week we've got Congressman Adam Schiff, who has a new book out called Midnight in Washington that takes a behind-the-scenes look at the impeachment fight where he was an impeachment manager. Also talks a lot about January 6th and the ramifications of that. Of course, Congressman Schiff is on the January 6th commission. And so we talked about the breaking news when it comes to subpoenas and that commission. A little later, we talk with Arash Markazi about John Gruden and the NFL and what executives are really like. We also talk about Kyrie Irving and the vaccine mandate in the NBA. And we talk about the Dodgers beating the Giants this week because that's my favorite story of the week. But before we get to that, a lengthy, in-depth conversation with Adam Schiff includes a lot of material here that we were not able to fit into the TV broadcast that's exclusive for this podcast. Here is Congressman Schiff. Congressman Schiff, welcome to The Issue Is, and congrats on the book being number one.
Thank you. No one could be more surprised than me.
Well, the book starts by talking about January 6th. And before we get into much of the specifics of the book, let's talk about the big news of this week. And it's related to January 6th. You're part of the January 6th commission. We want to show some video up on the screen of some folks that you all have subpoenaed. These are former Trump White House officials. Steve Bannon is saying he is not going to answer your subpoena. And now you're saying that he should potentially face criminal charges because of it. What specifically do you mean by criminal contempt? Do you think that Steve Bannon should be arrested if he doesn't come and testify?
Steve Bannon was subpoenaed to come appear this week, produce documents. He didn't either. And you can't just simply say, well, I don't care to show up for a deposition. That's not how compulsory process works. What our chairman has decided to do, and I fully support the decision, is we're going to have a business meeting on Tuesday. We're going to take up a report that recommends holding him in criminal contempt. If it passes out of our committee, as I expect it will, it'll be taken up on the House floor. And if it passes there, as I expect it will be sent to the Justice Department. And the law provides that the Justice Department has a duty to then present it to the grand jury. So yes, if you refuse legal process, you could be prosecuted. And if that's what's necessary to get answers, then that's what we'll do.
Ultimately, meaning you think that if he doesn't testify, that he should go to jail?
That will ultimately be the judge's decision, what kind of penalty, what kind of remedy to compel his testimony. But yes, I think people that refuse their legal obligations ought to be fined or go to jail, whatever is necessary to get them to submit to the lawful orders of the Congress and the courts.
Are you concerned, though, about the precedent that that might set for the future? Say the Republicans take over Congress and then they try to arrest you or Hunter Biden or Joe Biden or somebody else to try to get payback.
I'm more concerned, frankly, about the precedent of the last 4 years, where Trump official after Trump official just thumbed their nose at the Congress and knew there would be no repercussion for ignoring the law. At the time, you had an attorney general like Bill Barr, who himself was in contempt and wasn't about to enforce the law against those covering up for the president, the now former president. So I'm more worried about that precedent. Will Republicans abuse the power? Well, they have shown every interest and willingness in abusing power in any way. My guess is they will do that no matter what Democrats do responsibly. They will use power if they gain it to act irresponsibly, which is why we must make sure that Kevin McCarthy never goes near the Speaker's office.
Let's talk about the merits of what you're investigating on January 6th. One of the key questions you're trying to get at is, what was President Trump doing that day? What do you know now about what he was doing that day? And was he directing his supporters?
Well, you're absolutely right. That is one of the central questions in this investigation. There are a lot of things we're looking at. We're looking at how are these rallies organized? Where did the money come from? What understanding or expectation of violence did people have organizing them? But the biggest unknowns are what was taking place in the White House? What was taking place with the president? Why backup wasn't sent to the Capitol sooner? What the president knew about the propensity for violence that day? Was this an effort After everything else failed, after his litigation bombed, after his efforts to use the Justice Department to coerce Georgia or to manufacture false claims of fraud in the elections, after those things failed, was this the last-ditch effort to use violence or the threat of violence to get Mike Pence to violate his constitutional duty? Those are the questions we're determined to answer, among many others.
Do you have an answer to any of that yet, though?
I don't have a complete answer, no. We certainly have been gaining information. We made requests for voluminous documents, many of which we've received, others of which the former president is fighting. He doesn't want us to see the evidence. You can ask, well, why is that? What is he afraid of? But the good news is the current administration is not asserting executive privilege. They recognize these are extraordinary circumstances. This information really belongs to the American people.
In the book, you paint a picture of your experience on January 6th, and some GOP lawmakers were legitimately worried about your safety. We want to put this quote up on the screen. This is what you say. You can't let them see you, a Republican member said. And then another one said to me, he's right. Another Republican member said, I know these people. I can talk to them. I can talk my way through them. You're in a whole different category. So were they essentially suggesting that if this mob saw you, they were trying to kill you?
Yes, I think it was very clear what they were suggesting. One of them was carrying a wooden post that still had a hand sanitizer affixed to it that he was going to use to protect himself from these rioters. So they too were worried about their safety, but they were more concerned that I was a target of this mob. And at first, I was kind of touched by their evident concern. But then that feeling soon gave way to another, that if so many of them hadn't been pushing this big lie about the election, none of us would need to worry about our security. And what's so distressing today, Alex, is they continue to push that big lie all around the country. Even the third-ranking Republican was asked about it on Fox this weekend, and wouldn't deny the former president's false claims about the election being stolen. If people are led to believe that our elections can no longer be counted on to decide who should govern, that really does pave the way for violence. And that's one of the concerns I write about.
And that's Steve Scalise, who you're quoting right there. On January 6th itself, after they said that to you, were you legitimately scared for your own safety?
I was. You know, it was hard for me to evaluate initially how many people were outside the Capitol, how big and massive a crowd it was. I didn't learn until later how vigorously they were beating police officers. But when they started breaking glass in the House chamber, when the Capitol Police started shouting, you need to get out, there's nothing like that to get your attention. But it was one of those rare, maybe not so rare, traumatic situations where the trauma of it grows without time. I think for many members of Congress, once they did see all of that footage and realized just how massive that crowd was, it only accentuated how we felt about it. But I have to say, you know, those people that were attacking the Capitol that day, they believe the big lie. What so infuriated me about many of the people inside the chamber was that they pushed the big lie knowing it was a lie. And to me, that's unforgivable.
And on that day, you had warned that President Trump would try to cheat when it comes to the election, and your colleagues reminded you of that on January 6th. Here's another quote from the book. A lawmaker says, you warned that he would try to cheat again. It didn't require any great clairvoyance, I replied, and then I added, someone really should have impeached that son of a you-know-what. Of course, you were the impeachment manager. But what's interesting to note is you weren't always eager to impeach. Here you are on the very first episode of The Issue Is on May of 2018. On that day, you had written an op-ed in the New York Times about why Democrats shouldn't impeach the president. Let's watch.
Well, my main point is, ironically, Donald Trump is out there talking about impeachment to his base and trying to suggest Democrats are not interested in governing. They're just interested in getting rid of me. That's a trap I think he would like Democrats to fall in. I think we should let the investigations run their course, and Democrats would be wise to be campaigning on what they're going to do to deliver for their constituents on the economy and jobs, on health care and things that really affect their immediate lives.
What goes through your mind when you see that?
Well, you're absolutely right. I was not one of those people who was calling for Trump's impeachment the moment he got elected. Far from it. I was trying to push back against that, particularly while the investigation was still ongoing. And I think at the time you and I were talking, the Mueller investigation was still proceeding. We didn't know what his report would say. We didn't know what his conclusions would be. And so from my point of view, it was premature to be talking about the ultimate remedy. And I think, frankly, that helped me make the case in the Senate. The fact that I wasn't an earlier eager proponent, that I thought only under extraordinary circumstances should we use that remedy. But when we saw the president's further misconduct, and this was a really important factor to me, the president was on the phone with the head of Ukraine the day after Bob Mueller testified. That is, the day after he thought he escaped any responsibility, accountability for the Russian misconduct, he was back on the phone once again trying to get the help of another foreign country to help him cheat in an election. And you know, that was enough for me. That really convinced me that we needed to move forward with impeachment.
Well, you write about that Bob Mueller testimony, and what you've said about it is making some news, because you're suggesting that he may not have been all there mentally because of his age. And that was a troubling thing for a lot of you. Walk us through that, and what should we think about the Mueller investigation itself, knowing that?
Well, this was a very difficult chapter for me to write, because I have just incredible respect and reverence for Bob Mueller. I think he's a tremendous human being and tremendous public servant. But I also wanted to be candid about what it was like. And so I describe in the book asking the members of the Intelligence Committee to sit with me in the skiff in that bunker three floors below the Capitol and watch Mueller's first testimony before the Judiciary Committee hours before he would testify before our committee. And I was shocked at the changes that I had seen in him, that I witnessed. And we quickly began to change the nature of the questions and cut them down and make them much shorter and specific, not ask for narrative answers. And it's part of the historic record that I think needed to be told. But I wanted to tell it in a respectful way. I hope I did, because I think he's a tremendous public servant.
Do you think the expectation game for Robert Mueller got way off? I mean, there were a lot of people that thought there was this massive Russia conspiracy between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, that Robert Mueller was going to expose all of that, and that when it didn't happen, there was a lot of disappointment, distrust. What happened there? And the fact that Robert Mueller was having those difficulties, does that concern you?
Well, I think what happened, and this was really a situation with unequal resources in terms of, certainly in terms of propagating the message on the side of Donald Trump and on the side of Bob Mueller. When you look at what was actually produced by the Mueller investigation, by our own investigation, and that of good investigative journalism, it's very damning. Just look at one fact, Alex. The Trump campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, was giving internal campaign polling and information about their strategic thinking in battleground states to an agent of Russian intelligence, while that same Russian intelligence agency was embarking on a social media campaign to elect Donald Trump. Now, anyone else would call that collusion. The only question is whether it would be the crime of conspiracy. But when you have the biggest bully pulpit in the world, like Trump did, you can just repeat like a mantra, no collusion, no obstruction. And you've got Bob Mueller, on the other hand, who was utterly silent until his report. It's in terms of getting the point across, there's a really disparate advantage in the White House. And one other advantage the president had, the former president, is he had an attorney general in Bill Barr who was cravenly willing to completely misrepresent Bob Mueller's work. And one final observation about this. I think that Donald Trump believes that everyone is just like him, that everyone lies because he lies, everybody's corrupt because he's corrupt. I think in a kind of an opposite way, Bob Mueller, being a man of such great rectitude and integrity, presumes that other people behave the same way he does. And I have to think that it was a terrible shock to him to be so betrayed by Bill Barr, to have his work of 2 years so misrepresented. And I do think it a terrible shame that that he was not able to speak more plainly about his conclusions and about the criminality of the former president, particularly when it concerns obstruction of justice.
We're talking with Adam Schiff in his book, Midnight in Washington. He talks about his experience as an impeachment manager. Here's some of those arguments.
If the truth doesn't matter, we're lost. The framers couldn't protect us from ourselves if right and truth don't matter. And you know that what he did was not right.
We know that Mitt Romney eventually voted for impeachment. He was the only Republican that did. As you were actually making those arguments, did you think that there would be enough Republicans to convict him, to remove him? Did you realize that a lot of this was political theater? Did you think there was anything you could have said that would change the result?
I knew going into the trial that we were very likely going to lose. And I remember talking to the speaker about it, and I said, you know, I think the challenge is how do you win by losing? And I think the way you win by losing is by recognizing that there are two juries. There's the jury in the Senate, which is going to be so heavily predisposed against you. And then there's the jury of the American people. And my goal was to win over the jury of the American people if I could, knowing that getting Republican senators to vote to convict a president of their party would be enormously difficult. But I will say this about that argument you just played. To me, this was one of the core realizations of the trial in the last 4 years. When I was making those arguments about the president's lack of morality, the inability to tell right from wrong, I could see each senator's reaction. None of them, none of the Republicans, certainly none of the Democrats, none of them were shaking their heads. Oh, no, that's not the Donald Trump we know. He would never do that. They understood exactly who we were dealing with. Yet they lacked the courage to fulfill their oath. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how well the Constitution is drafted. There's nothing wrong with the impeachment remedy or how it's written. What it requires is people of good faith to give those constitutional provisions the kind of meaning that the founders intended. And if they're not willing to do that, then none of it works. And that's, I think, why our system is at such risk right now.
You write about the past, but you also write about the future. And when you look into the future, there's a real possibility that Kevin McCarthy of California becomes the next Speaker of the House. You write about the fact that you had an experience with him on a plane, and then he ended up lying entirely about your conversation to the press, and then basically suggesting to you, you know, that's the game, that's how it works. What does this country look like if Kevin McCarthy is Speaker of the House?
Well, it would look exactly like if Donald Trump were Speaker of the House, because effectively he would be. Kevin McCarthy is not going to stand up to Donald Trump in any way. And that means that Donald Trump today is telling people in a statement that he issued this week that if they don't prove non-existent fraud in the last election, that he's going to tell people not to vote in the next one. And so Kevin McCarthy will carry that message and other messages, and he will take actions in the House, whatever Donald Trump wants. That conversation that I spell out in the book, that was in 2010. That was years before Donald Trump. But in this respect, Kevin McCarthy was really made for a moment like this, when his party doesn't believe the truth really matters. They believe in alternate facts. They believe the truth isn't truth. You say whatever you need to say. You do whatever you need to do to capture power. And I realize there's a lot of cynicism about politics in the public, but that is not the way it is. That's not how most of us operate. And we cannot allow the leadership of either party, in this case, the leadership of the Republican Party, to occupy such a important position of responsibility if it is utterly unwilling to tell the truth about something as fundamental as our elections.
Don't you think that Donald Trump is the overwhelming favorite to be the Republican nominee for president next time, assuming that he runs? And Joe Biden's poll numbers right now are not very good. I mean, there's a real good chance that he wins again.
First of all, I'm certain that Donald Trump is going to run for president again. And I say that because I think he would find it intolerable if someone else got all that attention, if Nikki Haley or Mike Pence or DeSantis or any of these people were to be the Republican nominee, he would go out of his mind. So I think pathologically, he cannot help but run And at the moment, he has got such a grip on that party that I would certainly expect if he runs, he'll be the nominee. If he's the nominee, we are going to beat him because we have to, because the democracy will ride on it. We will not survive another 4 years of Donald Trump and have a country with a democracy that looks anything like what it does today. In terms of President Biden's poll numbers, once we get these bills passed, which we will, and hopefully very soon, I think you'll see those numbers go back up. And once we get this pandemic under control, you'll also see those numbers rise. It's tough because you have a cohort of Americans who are just unwilling to get vaccinated. Some because they're afraid of the vaccine because of misinformation. Some because they view it now as a political issue. But unless we can persuade enough of our fellow Americans to get vaccinated so that we can get the kind of herd immunity that we need, it's going to be very hard to turn the corner on this awful, awful virus.
Let's end on a couple quick questions just about you. We've known each other for a long time, and I knew you before you were this big national figure, right? Before Donald Trump.
Knew you before you were this big national figure.
You were not seen as this, like, hyper-partisan guy. And then Donald Trump came and you became this national thing, this symbol of the resistance. How did Donald Trump change your life?
Well, you're absolutely right. I have not changed. I still don't view myself as partisan. I am anti-Trump. Look, I think he wants to be an autocratic ruler of the country. He's made common cause with autocrats around the globe, and I think he is immoral and untruthful, and I think he's been a disaster. So, yes, I'm going to fight that because I think it's dangerous for the country. That doesn't, in my view, make me a partisan. On the January 6th Select Committee, I worked with two very conservative Republicans, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. All of us on that Select Committee worked together extremely well. There is no partisanship on that committee. That's the way it should be. But I view her and both Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger as the heirs of the Republican Party, as those that still believe in a party of ideology and ideas. Trump certainly made me a household name. He actually gave me a whole lot of household names, as a matter of fact. But I don't feel I've changed. I do think the circumstances have.
And last question. I know you actually wrote this book yourself, which almost nobody in Washington actually does. It is your first book. When did you find the time, and how did you remember everything? Because I know you weren't, like, journaling every day.
Over the last 4 years, any number of folks, especially my colleagues, said, I hope you're writing this down. You really need to be writing this down. You're in the middle of history. And I would say, when do I possibly have the time to write any of this down? And then the pandemic hit, and I was confined to quarters like so many Americans. And I finally said to myself, if I'm ever going to write this down, I need to do it now, and I ought to do it while it's fresh. But I have to tell you, I thought it would be easier than it was. It was a lot harder than I thought. I thought I would just remember all these things, but I had to go back and do careful research and watch old interviews with you and with others to get back in the moment. And some of that was traumatic, but other parts of it were really inspiring once again to literally hear Alexander Vindman's voice again and to see Marie Yovanovitch stare down the President of the United States and testify when she was told not to. So those moments once again inspired me.
Well, so are you saying that you did a lot of TV interviews? You had a lot to reference.
I did. I basically had a video journal, that was helpful.
That was your version of a journal. All right, Congressman, we always appreciate the time from week one until now, and now best-selling author Adam Schiff. Great conversation.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Congressman Schiff. Now we change things up. Very different kind of conversation with Arash Markazi, one of our friends, who made it in studio for the first time in a couple years. Great to see Arash in person. Here's our conversation.
With us in the House for the first time in a very long time. Arash, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Thanks for having us. It's been a long time since I put this suit on,
I know.
It still fits, thankfully.
It looks good. Arash, of course, is a longtime sports journalist who worked for ESPN, the LA Times. He is currently the host of the Arash Markazi Show on the Mightier 1090. We encourage you to listen to that. Mm-hmm. All right, Arash, so the Gruden story. What does this tell us, sort of bigger picture, about the culture in the NFL and the culture of the people that are running the NFL.
It gave us a peek, like when they're hiring people, when they're firing people, when you look at who they surround themselves with, when you look at professional sports, the number of women, minorities, is such a small number. And it begins to make sense when you look at how they're talking to each other and how comfortable that they are saying the words that they said. So listen, we could talk about John Gruden all we want. It's not just about John Gruden. They are comfortable throwing out these names. Again, the men who were talking to each other have been in professional football their entire lives.
So what should we... I mean, are there changes that are coming? Is this the sign that things are changing, or is this basically just revealing the tip of the iceberg?
Listen, this is a moment of reflection for, I think, all teams. Again, John Gruden, we could talk about him specifically. We all know what we said to each other, and here's the problem. They call it locker room talk. It's not locker room talk. These are men in positions of power. Again, they sign guys. They waive players. They hire people. This is a moment of reflection for all teams out there. What are we doing to be more inclusive?
And he had said some pretty nasty things about Michael Sam, who was the first openly gay person to be drafted in the NFL. Carl Nassib, the first openly gay person to play in the NFL yes. in a regular season game, is on the Raiders. And then took a personal day to try to process all of this. How is he doing and how does he fit into all of this?
He needed to take some time off because when you are with a team, the coach is so revered. You call him coach, right? I mean, this is a man that you respect. This is a man that you trust. And to have that man that you respect and trust so much to say the things that he said, it really shined a light on why so many players do not want to come out, right? They're not comfortable doing that because the conversations that we saw, and you could say it was 10 years ago, 11 years, it doesn't matter. Those conversations still happen today. And so there's a lot of players out there who are very nervous about having these conversations.
How has he been treated privately? What have you heard from the people you've talked to?
Listen, privately, I've heard he's been treated fantastically. But what happens when he's not in the room? We all wonder that. I think he wonders that. When he leaves the locker room, what is being said? So when we read these emails, again, we can focus on one person or two people. There's a lot of players out there who are not comfortable having these conversations because, like, my coach may say one thing, I close the door, he texts a friend, and he says some things.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a much bigger story than just sports. It's the intersection of sports and politics and culture. And another story that's sort of that intersection is what's happening right now with Kyrie Irving, who is one of the best players in the league, plays for the Brooklyn Nets. He has not gotten vaccinated. Right now, not being allowed to play home games in New York. Here's what he said on Instagram.
It's about choosing what's best for you. You think I really want to lose money? You think I really want to give up on my dream to go after a championship? That's a dream come true. I've been working on that since I was in fourth grade. You think I want to give up my livelihood because of a mandate, because I don't have accommodations, because I'm unvaccinated? Come on. I'm not going to be used as a person in this agenda.
So right now, unvaccinated people are not supposed to work in places like in New York. What do you make of what Kyrie Irving has to say?
I'm going to preface this by saying Kyrie is one of the smartest players that I know. But in those From a basketball IQ. But he went to Duke. He's a very intelligent man. But I'll tell you, some of the conversations I've had, he said, I think the earth is flat. I don't think there was a Tyrannosaurus Rex. And I'm having this conversation with him a couple of years ago, and it went viral. And I'm like, does this man really believe what he says? And I watched that clip, and I'm wondering, what does he believe? Because I don't know what he believes. If he wants to be a voice for the voiceless, that's fine. He didn't really make a point. He has not been vaccinated. He's not, like, anti-vaccine. He's not pro-vaccine. I really don't know what Kyrie believes, and I don't even know if Kyrie knows what he believes.
But it is a big sacrifice, what he's talking about there, to essentially walk away from the game, which is what he's being forced to do because of these rules. So why is he doing it?
I mean, to be honest, nobody knows, and this is what's so confusing, and this is why his teammates and his coaches and his GM have said, until you figure that out, Kyrie, and until you get vaccinated, we don't want you to be with the team, because it made no sense, Alex. What, you're going to play the road games, but you're not going to practice, you're not going to play the home games, that it goes again, he's on a championship contending team. According to Las Vegas, the Brooklyn Nets are the favorites to win. And he's saying, you know what? Like, I'm good. I'm not going to play. I'm not going to get vaccinated. I'm not like anti-vaccine, but I want to be a voice for the voice. I mean, he's not making a ton of sense right now.
It's been interesting the way that the players have reacted to the vaccine mandate. It's clear that there is still vaccine hesitancy, among a lot of the players that got vaccinated.
100%. I mean, you look at the teams here in Los Angeles. I know a number of players got the vaccine but did not want to. They got it begrudgingly. So the players here have been vaccinated, but a number of them did not. Listen, they're just not comfortable. And you and I walk around town, we have friends or we know people who don't want to get the vaccine or who got the vaccine, who don't want. Like, you could do your own homework. And I mean, at the end of the day, look at the research, talk to the doctors. Every doctor you've had on this show says get the vaccine. But there are still a certain contingent who don't want to.
Yeah, I mean, look, LeBron James has been very vocal on a lot of things, said that he didn't want to be that vocal on this. If he would have taken a shot on camera, posted it to his 100 million plus Instagram followers, that could have potentially made a difference.
It would have been huge. None of these guys, though, wanted to be the face of the vaccine. You would have thought a team that was 100% vaccinated, LeBron James and Anthony Davis and all these guys, they really didn't want to touch the topic. Yes, we've been vaccinated. We're all good to go, but, like, let's move on.
Right. We are back now with Arash Markazi, sports journalist of the Arash Markazi Show. What a series. What a game. Yeah. What a terrible ending.
It really was, and you had a great point. Like, that took it away from the Dodgers. I know the Giants fans are so upset that that wasn't a check swing. You cheated us. Listen, it was a fantastic series. At the end of the day, Alex, they lost because they scored 10 runs during a five-game series. So, listen, I thought Max Scherzer should have had his moment. It should have been a swing and a mix. It should have been a pop fly, something like that. Dodger fans were robbed of that, but at the end of the day, I'll take this position over the position of losing the game.
Our friends watching in the Bay Area now are like, boo-hoo, Dodger fans. We were robbed.
That's right.
And the bad part is now they can say that, whereas before, if Scherzer would have had a traditional strikeout, that wouldn't be the case as much. But it was a great series and a great season by the Giants. What an impressive team they are. The Dodgers, though, didn't stop them from celebrating last night. We've got some video of them having a good time all night long. What are the big challenges remaining for the Dodgers team?
Well, listen, you have to get past the Atlanta Braves, and the problem there is they have to go on the road, Alex. Like, as soon as that game was done, they did not, I mean, they're having a good time there in the pictures, but then they hop on a flight to Atlanta. But this is it. I don't want to call it a done deal, but that was their toughest challenge. The San Francisco Giants was their toughest challenge. I think they're going to repeat as champions.
We will see. Of course, either way, they're either going to face the Houston Astros or the Boston Red Sox in the World Series, two teams that cheated against them when they were in the World Series. The Dodgers lost those World Series, so they would get a chance to avenge but have to beat the Braves first. All right, we want to get some predictions quickly from you while you're here. So you just predicted that you think the Dodgers are going to repeat.
I think so. Listen, they've been the best team all year, and Max Scherzer is already a Dodgers legend, Alex. Yeah. I mean, he is a legend. Not only on the mound, but the way he celebrates. That shirt comes off so fast. The champagne. He's having a good time.
He looks like a rush at a party. All right. NBA Finals, because that's going to be a big year.
Continuing the homer trend here, Alex. The Lakers over the Brooklyn Nets, because even without our friend Kyrie Irving, I like Brooklyn to advance to the finals. But the Lakers were built to win this season. You can make all the jokes about how old they are. They were built to win this year. They will win this year.
Let's hope they don't get injured this year. The Super Bowl, which is going to be here in Los Angeles SoFi Stadium.
Listen, Alex, last year we had the first time ever Tampa Bay playing a home game, continuing trifecta with the homerific picks. Rams over Chargers. Two home teams playing in their home stadium. It's going to be fantastic.
You are really being bold on this one and not giving a lot of love to our friends watching the rest of the state of California. But that would be something. We don't know who's going to play in the Super Bowl. We do know who's going to play the Super Bowl halftime show.
That's
it's going to be quite a lineup. We got Dr. Dre, awesome. Snoop Dogg, Mary J. Blige, Eminem all playing.
And you know the date of the Super Bowl? 213. It is such a perfect Los Angeles halftime show on February 13th.
Our thanks to Arash, our thanks to Congressman Schiff, and our thanks to the Dodgers for winning this week. We hope they eventually win the World Series as well. Right here on Fox 11 is the home of the World Series on TV. Thank you very much for listening this week. Next week, we've got quite a show. Andrew Yang is coming in studio for the first time. Talk about his new party, his new book, a lot going on with him. Also, we're going to have a debate between Anna Kasparian on the left and Christian Walker on the right. That's going to be very interesting. For now, though, I'm Alex Michelson. Thanks for listening to The Issue Is. See you next week.